And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where you are on this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition on Saturday night, March 5th, I believe, to the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hogan. For the next 3 hours, I'm going to bring you a continuing story, which is really unbelievable. About a little over 2 months ago, almost now 3 months, December, January, February, it's first week in March, we began a series of remarkable experiments transmitting radio signals, ordinary EM radio transmissions, electromagnetic radiation, first on a very large antenna with a very large effective power of something like 500,000 watts, and now with a much smaller handheld device, and I'll explain why we're doing that in a minute. And we sent our first test transmissions in the direction of this object that came zipping through the solar system several years ago in October of 2017, an object that NASA named Oumuamua, which kind of generally means first scout going before, that kind of thing. Anyway, during its quick passage through the solar system, it was discovered very early on by tracking the orbit that it was on what's called a hyperbolic trajectory. It had never been here before. It entered the solar system at excess of what's called escape velocity, meaning it was falling faster toward the sun than if it had been, sitting still and just had kind of wandered into the gravitational influence in the Milky Way. And it made a sharp right-hand turn and departed in the direction of Pegasus at roughly 90 degrees, again, in excess of escape velocity from the sun, never to return. So in December of 2021, around December 4th, it was this sliver in the dark about 2.5 billion miles away, utterly mysterious, and there was a serious groundswell of discussion in the mainstream astronomical community following our discussion here on the other side of midnight several weeks before, that Oumuamua was not a natural object. Astronomers tried to fit it into several categories. First, it was termed a comet. Then when no cometary signatures like a coma or a tail were detected, it was called an asteroid. And then when anomalous motions were detected, it was shifted back in the mainstream to a cometary object. But actually, there were several mainstream astronomers following our lead, which stated very bluntly that it was potentially an interstellar active artificial probe of a class basically devised by a Stanford engineer back in the 1960s named Robert Bracewell. A Bracewell probe in Bracewell's model was an artificial object created by some distant extraterrestrial civilization that instead of sending radio signals into its section of the galaxy would create a whole series of very sophisticated robotic probes, AI probes, run by artificial intelligence, and they would dispatch them on trajectories to their nearest star systems. And even if it took them centuries at the sublight speeds, rocket technology, obsolete rockets, they would eventually wind up in this distant solar system. They would go into orbit and they would lie in wait. They would orbit quietly waiting for a potential indication of intelligence in that particular star system. And the idea behind Bracewell's model that a culture would create hundreds of these, or maybe even 1,000 or more, and send them in all directions to hang out in the star's globe, several hundred light years around them. And they would simply wait for the probe to pick up radio signals indicative of a high technology civilization capable of manipulating the electromagnetic spectrum with all the associated technologies that go into creating radio, certainly radio that can be heard across interstellar distances. And they would then send signals from an orbit around the star back to the planet and the culture that was sending radio. And thereby the model was that there would be a two-way communication established between the indigenous civilization, the artificial probe that had come from a distant solar system, and the probe would then record a whole bunch of these transmissions and then send it back to its home world, its home solar system, hundreds or maybe a thousand or more light years distant. That was the model. So when Oumuamua came zipping through the solar system, there were some people, us at the kind of forefront, who said because of the characteristics of its trajectory, the fact that if you look in detail at the numbers attached to its swift hyperbolic orbit around the sun, including its diving into the solar system at 32 degrees, all of those numbers had over and over again things like phi, 19.5, et cetera, et cetera. So to our mind, the geometry of the orbit itself was a hallmark of its artificiality. For other reasons, totally separate reasons, Avi Loeb at Harvard and several others also got the idea and began to promulgate it that this thing was an artificial probe. Well, the fat was in the fire or the cat among the pigeons or whatever other cliche you might want to drag out of the closet, because since this really was the first confirmed interstellar visitor by mainstream astronomy, by mainstream science, regardless of its origins, there was a great deal of interest in its composition, where it came from, and there have been all kinds of efforts to try to track the trajectory back to figure out where it came from. What's really weird is that when you do that, it turns out that the solar system literally walked up on, if you can think of hundreds of miles per second orbiting around the center of the galaxy as walking, it literally walked up on this object which was sitting almost motionless relative to the surrounding stars, which in and of itself is really kind of weird, almost like someone had put it in our path, like putting a buoy on the course of a giant ocean liner in the middle of the dark Atlantic and waiting for the two objects to meet. So Oumuamua passed the test of being interstellar. It certainly passed some of the tests of being artificial. But during the time that it came whipping around the sun, the only public effort that we could track down was an effort by, oddly enough, a Russian oligarch who lives in Northern California and who has a few billion extra dollars to kind of spend on whatever he wants to. And he funded a week of listening time at one of the world's premier radio observatories in Green Bank, West Virginia, long about December. And the specifications of the program were that if something as small as a cell phone or a smartphone had been broadcasting from Oumuamua at its distance from Earth at that time, which was well beyond the orbit of Mars and approaching the orbit of Jupiter, I mean, it was really moving fast. This radio telescope listening session over about a week, several sessions, would have picked up the signal. Nothing was heard, or so we have been told. What I found kind of curious, if there was serious interest in the artificiality model, is that no one under the rubric of Bracewell's original idea, which was that such a probe would only respond if it got a message, if it got signals, if someone actually tried to talk to it, no one that I'm aware of, either the deep state, the military, the mainstream international astronomical community, amateurs, nobody tried to communicate with the Muamua as it was zipping past the earth and departing into the far distant dark. And I wonder why, even now, that nobody thought to give it a call. So, long around last December, late November, early December, we crafted a Enterprise mission effort on the part of ourselves and two very interesting researchers, David Sarita and Jimmy Blanchett. Jimmy had the antenna, David had the codes, and so we all agreed that what we would do is to craft a few minute long message comprised of sacred geometry, sacred frequencies, fundamental constants, some scanned images like pictograms, kind of like what the Arecibo Observatory sent many years ago under the aegis of Frank Crick and Carl Sagan. And we would beam it using Blanchett's antenna in northern Arizona periodically during the other side of midnight on a Saturday night on February 4th in the direction of Muamua, and we would see what happened if anybody answered the call. Well, obviously, what's happened since has kind of obviated the ancient kind of archaic Bracewell probe model, because no sooner had Blanchett started transmitting, and remember, given that a Muamua was something like 2.5 billion miles away beyond the orbit of Neptune at that time on that night, and receding at tens of miles per second, even as we transmitted, David and I and a few others calculated that it would take almost 4 hours at the speed of light, the speed of normal radio transmissions, for our signal to get to a Muamua. And then, of course, you start the stopwatch running, and it takes, if they answered instantly, which likely they would not, it would take 4 hours for the information for a return radio signal to get back. That was the minimum time. Actually, if you figure in different languages, decoding, figuring out the frequencies, deciding what to say, whether to respond, all of those things could have added even more hours, if not days, to the total round-trip time. Well, things happened very quickly and very dramatically and totally threw the sublight or speed of light model into the wastebasket, because about 2 minutes after Blanchett began sending the signals, over the course of the next several hours, something like 6 spacecraft, and the reason we know they're spacecraft is because of their behavior and their geometry. He was able to zoom in on the low light level television camera he had mounted and was recording images, video from during the transmission sequence. Over the next several hours, 6 different spacecraft with different geometries popped into and then disappeared out of normal 3D space directly above the antenna, photobombing literally that patch of sky where the antenna was directed with a Muamua 2.5 billion miles away beyond it in the dark. 6 of them. And they would come on, they'd hang out for a moment, a few frames, and they disappear. They didn't track across the sky. They didn't mimic airplanes. They literally popped into 3D space and then disappeared like they had beamed in and out to another dimension, which one could conventionally call hyperspace. And it all happened in 2 minutes after he started the transmission. Now, we can interpret this, as we will have some fun doing tonight, in a variety of ways. The most interesting and the least hypothesis-laden idea is that the Earth is kind of surrounded by a whole bunch of extraterrestrial civilizations, and they're a lot closer to us than the Muamua. In fact, they're hanging out somewhere between us and the moon. It takes about 1.25 light seconds to get a signal to the moon and back another 1.25 seconds. So in 2 minutes, they could have been within a sphere two light minutes in radius. The sun is 8 light minutes away, give or take. So they could have been like 1/8 of the distance to the sun. And since the sun is 93 million miles away, in other words, they could have been something like 10 million miles out there and went, whoa, who is transmitting tonight with a very powerful signal? Let's go over and take a look. That's the really dumb, simple, stupid model. There are much more interesting but more complicated hypotheses to explain what happened that first night. On the radios, remember, we were also listening for return signals on the radio, on the two frequencies, the two sacred frequencies, the two special hyperdimensional frequencies we had chosen to transmit on, which was 144.1 megahertz, that's million cycles per second, and 432 megahertz, million cycles per second. Well, what was very curious is that after Blanchett stopped transmitting, he switched his antenna system to receive. And no time during that experiment or any time during subsequent experiments did he receive radio signals back on the antenna system and the radio receivers attached to it that was used in the transmission. But what he did get and what David Sarita got were reception of transmissions on a handheld radio, which is made by the Chinese. Brand name is Baofeng. It's kind of the handheld portable ham radio choice of a whole bunch of hams all over the planet. It apparently is the best technology. You can either transmit about 8 watts or you can receive. You can do one or the other or you can do both. You need a license to transmit. But receiving, obviously, it's like any other radio. You just listen. And what David did was to listen and record those signals. And he'll describe how he does this momentarily. And Blanchett did the same thing. And at widely separated points, two points that night on the evening of December 4th on planet Earth, those radios were alive, not just with the sound of music, but with the sound of actual specific coded radio return signals initiated within minutes of our sending a test transmission to Oumuamua. And obviously, because they came in much quicker than the radio time delay between us and Oumuamua, that is one of the reasons why we're all kind of in agreement that whatever we're getting on the radios, it's not actually a radio transmission. It's not electromagnetic radiation. Something else is triggering the speaker. Think of it as a kind of a hyperdimensional tractor beam, which vibrates the speaker, which in turn, because speakers are surrounded by magnets, generates in the radio an electromagnetic induction. So that's why you can actually plug cables into the radio and feed it into a computer and record this on a computer. But it's not really radio. It's something obviously that is traveling many, many, many times faster than the stagial speed of light. So what could it be? And much more important, who are we talking to? Well, over the next several weeks, ending a couple weeks ago on February 20th for the time being, we have been upping our game, expanding our experimental envelope, and we introduced a whole new factor to the ongoing experiment. Because when we decided on one of those weekends not to send the signals to Oumuamua, but instead, at my suggestion, we sent the same signals to the moon, one of the interesting things that we got back was a coded series of numbers that instantly led us to a very phenomenal and unique place here on planet Earth, i.e. Stonehenge. So then we thought, John Womack and I and a couple other people thought, well, wait a minute. What if we were to take one of these handheld radios and within the environs of the most ancient known astronomical observatory built on Earth and built to track, among other things, the phases and cycles of the moon, which is why I think our moon transmission got Stonehenge in the conversation. We said to ourselves, well, what if we were to transmit to our same unknown receivers, our audience out there, our mysterious people who are obviously listening and will respond if we send them information? What if we use Stonehenge as a kind of a ground plane or a location to do the next phase of the experiment? And so several weeks later, on February 4th, we sent our Intrepid Away Team agent, our explorer extraordinaire, Maria Wheatley, who we will introduce shortly in the morning in the conversation. And we sent her into Stonehenge, and it turned out to be during the height of an extraordinary British hurricane in the middle of the winter, with winds topping 120 miles an hour in some sections of the island. And I guess it was 80 miles an hour around Stonehenge when she was able to, on a very sleety and rainy afternoon, manage to stand there in the center of the monument and send and receive another set of coded signals. Well, we fast forward the film now, and we've done this now twice because we decided that we would try it one more time. Maria did. She is definitely an intrepid explorer. And this time, because of this bizarre weather, which has persisted, she was unable. They had closed Stonehenge down. So on the afternoon of the 20th, she was unable to get into the monument. But fortunately, when Robin and I were in Guatemala measuring the sacred sites there, we discovered, particularly around Chichen Itza, that if you are within a few miles of one of these ancient sacred sites, information, you can see measurable physical instrumentation respond. You can record the results. I did this with the Accutron system. So it was on that basis, on that theory, that I said to Maria, well, if you get within, you know, a mile or two of the monument and you start recording and you start transmitting, we should get very interesting data. And that is exactly what occurred, as you're going to hear. So before I bring on our panelists tonight, I want to go through a couple of very important things. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, if you are a new listener, I was on Coast to Coast the other night, and I presume we have a lot of people from the Coast audience who are kind of curious as to what's going on over here at the other side of midnight. Well, if you go to the website, click on, or you type in, or you input theothersideofmidnight.com, that will take you to our URL, our homepage. Click on tonight's banner, which says rather succinctly what we're doing: open hailing frequencies, continuing Stonehenge ET transmissions, new responses. Click on that banner. That will take you to the guest page. Right under the guest page, you will see fast links to items with my name, John, David, Thomas, and Maria. Click on my name. That will take you down to the section of the page Radio with Pictures, where I have a couple of news items at the top. Those are links to the ongoing progress in the unveiling and commissioning of all the instrumentation of the Webb Space Telescope, which is successfully proceeding to its operational phase somewhere in July of this year. Those first two links take you to the NASA site. The first is a blog describing the latest commissioning results. The second is Where is the Telescope? Gives you a kind of a overview of the instruments and the temperatures and physically where it is around the L2 point and all that. Item number three. Now, this is very important because, as you're going to hear later on in the morning, one of the things that has happened from these succeeding transmissions, certainly from Maria's first efforts in Stonehenge on the 4th of February, is that we got messages which, when David decoded them, gave us a number that at the, you know, except to David, it was a number that kind of hung there in space with no real connective glue. It was 20.6 was the number. And David said immediately, oh, that's the royal qubit that he's figured out from separate research over many years. But I like multiple evidence, multiple lines of evidence. So I was kind of looking around for something more than that. And about 2 weeks later, we had the second shoe drop. Because as you may know, we're going to talk about this in some level later on in the morning. About 2 weeks after February 4th, the event that kind of rocked the world took over, and that was this extraordinary event in the South Pacific called the Tonga explosion. We're not quite sure what it was, but it appears to have been some kind of major event that erupt in an unprecedented fashion, equal to tens of megatons of explosive capacity, and it shot a cloud of material up over 34 miles. Well, when we get back into the conversation in the next couple of minutes, I'm going to go through why this is important, because now on the transmissions that we recorded from Maria's experiments in Stonehenge on the 20th, David believes we got another heads up for something having to do with Belarus and Ukraine. And the reason that's important is because this was recorded 4 days before Russia, under the aegis of Vladimir Putin, invaded Ukraine. So one of the important questions of the morning is whoever we're talking to somehow out of time? Are they literally able to see the future, relay events in the future, straddle different timelines? Are they able to cross time? Are we talking to hyper-dimensional beings that literally live outside or away from our three-dimensional time? Because now twice, certainly the first time with the Tonga explosion, and now potentially with Ukraine and the beginning of this extraordinarily tragic war, it's appearing as if we're getting advanced information beyond time, beyond space, beyond any kind of natural proclivity for this kind of information to be, basically available. So is it in fact something coming to us from some other dimension as part of our ongoing effort to communicate beyond the earth, beyond time, beyond our current reality? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. When we return, we'll try for the rest of this morning to bring you some potential answers to that crucial set of questions. We shall return.
Of course, from this academic scientific side, to try to show that from that point of view, that even in the depths of the data that they're presenting, they don't have a case. they've misrepresented things, they've distorted things in the public representations, and of course, I'm not alone in having come to that conclusion. Number one, there are an increased number of deaths for 2020. But number two, these are not caused by COVID-19. They're caused by the biological and psychological effects of the lockdowns themselves. Because when you lock people down, when you wreck an economy, you get an increase in heart disease, in cancers. You get an increase in what is called deaths of despair. You get suicides, you get drug addiction going up and overdoses killing people. And all of these things put together, by my estimate in my research paper, shows that as many as 600,000 people died in 2020 from just these things. Deaths by despair and the effects of the lockdowns and the forced masking. This is Dr. James DeMeo, and I'm speaking to you from the other side of the news. Your program, I must say, compliment you. You're doing a great job in assisting to get around these barriers of censorship and erasure that the mainstream media is doing. So it's very important, and I congratulate you for the work you're doing. I'm an invited guest on the other side of the news, and I found it to be a very enlightening and helpful and wonderful experience being interviewed by three intelligent people.
Welcome back, everyone, to this Saturday night, to March 5th of 2022, here on the other side of midnight in the land of enchantment. What I'd like to do now is I'd like to introduce our panelists for the evening. We have many important guests, some of whom have been intrepid explorers like Maria. Others are actually working on the analysis of what we have discovered, what we have recorded, what we have received, and we're in the process of trying to figure out what in fact it all means, starting with who are we talking to. So without further ado, let me introduce my guest for the evening. Let me stop this. Okay, I'm doing kind of real-time radio here, so pardon me, folks. Okay. Our first guest is, of course, Maria Wheatley. Maria is a second-generation dowser who was taught by European master dowsers, her late father, and Chinese geomance. She's a leading authority on geodetic earth energies, ley lines, and stone circles. She's also an accomplished author of several books on sacred sites and dowsing, and you can read the entire bio there on the website. John Womack began leaving his body in the fall of 1965, answering psychic distress calls from people and spirits. He cut his Samaritan teeth on comic books, and cartoons such as Space Ghost, Superman, Batman, etc., etc. In school, he grew accustomed to being the smartest kid in the class and, of course, the most bullied. excelling in geometry, algebra, trigonometry, calculus, physics, and chemistry. He is a graduate of high school with a double major in math and science and a minor in English literature. With his current background, he is the he's a premier videographer. He does video editing. He does sound profiling, spectral analysis, and he is actually currently the host and executive producer of a show called The OBE Show, The Out-of-Body Experience, and it's available on Paraflix, Roku, Amazon, Fire, Apple TV, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And again, you can see his entire bio there on The Other Side of Midnight on the guest page. David Sarita was born in Edmonton, Alberta, August 21, 1961. He is now a very accomplished expert in sacred geometry, sacred frequencies. He has produced and scored music for meditation, frequencies for tuning consciousness. He and his wife had a meditation practice and consciousness course series on audio and video called Quantum Regenesis. And I kind of roped him into this because it turns out that an awful lot of the messaging seems to fall within his bailiwick and with his area of professional experience. He also designs and makes harmonic field transmitters, and I think we're going to have him describe what a harmonic field transmitter is. Thomas Mathers, a.k.a. James Tiege, is a Grammy-nominated musician and a fervent futurist with keen interest in space and technology, global politics, meditation, metaphysics, sacred frequencies and geometry, ancient sculptures, and exopolitics. Over the last 20 years, James has traveled to over 50 countries, sharing his music and ideas around the world with an honest, logical, and adventurous passion for the truth. He has visited many of the sacred ancient sites on multiple continents and has become a well-informed and proud generalist, bridging concepts, ideas, and theories across many disciplines and areas of research, extending from the physics of reality into what we're all trying to figure out tonight, more of the unknown. And last but not least, my dear friend and colleague, Ron Gerbron, a proudly uncredentialed polymath with a deep interest in the study of archaeology, especially Martian archaeology. Throughout, he actually attended both Stanford and Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, simultaneously before he gave up on academia, too constraining, and left to travel on many continents overseas. And throughout all that time, he focused his core attention on the metrology of our paleo history, particularly that on other planets, especially looking into the implications of all the ruins that for the last 50 years NASA has been quietly discovering and not telling us about on Mars. So without further ado, welcome everyone to The Other Side of Midnight.
Hi, Richard.
Hi, David.
Incredible presentation you're leading with, so meticulous, such incredibly fine details that I really appreciate.
Well, thank you. We have a lot of new people who are listening are obviously saying to themselves, what in the world are they talking about? Mm-hmm. So, by the way, I made one mistake. The messaging that we sent on the Christmas weekend with Jimmy's antenna was the messaging that contained the codes of Tonga. Maria's took place on the 4th of February from Stonehenge, her first foray there, and the message of Tonga itself actually exploded on January 15th. So I pardon everyone for leading them down a blind canyon. I'm doing this all from memory, not from notes. And there's been so much going on. It's like those old TV programs where they said, follow the bouncing ball. The problem is that we have an entire, you know, coterie of tennis players all bouncing balls all over the court simultaneously, and following any one ball at any one time is just a bit difficult. So before we get into anything, I want to introduce Maria. Maria, are you with us?
Yes. Hi,
there
Richard.
You are. Okay, this is our intrepid, what should we call you? We should think of a name, because archaeologist is so kind of banal. You know, she's kind of like a singular member of the Enterprise away team that we send into Stonehenge now twice to do something and see if we can open hailing frequencies. And boy, have we ever. So what I'd like you to do is to walk us through everything that happened on the morning and afternoon of the 20th as you attempted to transmit for the second time from the center of Stonehenge.
Yes, well, on the 20th, like you said in the introduction, Richard, the weather was very inclement, and there was very high, strong winds. And also, in one of the pictures that I sent in, I've shown how the Salisbury Plain looked. Stonehenge is on the edge of the Salisbury Plain, and it was on high alert. So red flags were flying everywhere, which means you can't turn at a particular angle if you see a red flag.
Wait. When you say red flags, in other words, there are British military MOD, you know, Ministry of Defense installations all over the Salisbury Plain, and they've kind of crowded out Stonehenge, which sits kind of in a corner, and you, if there's some kind of an alert or tests or operations from some of these military installations, they literally kind of guide you around, and sometimes you can't even get in.
So if you imagine that surrounding Stonehenge 360 degrees, there are military establishments north, south, east, west, everywhere, including our largest nuclear biological center on Porton Down. So that's the stance around it. But we must remember that the Salisbury Plain and Stonehenge itself is the largest spiritual and megalithic capital in the British Isles. On the Salisbury Plain alone, there's 2,000 monuments just on that area alone, 26 miles by 26 miles. So it's absolutely enormous, the archaeology and the unusual burials there, to say the least. So I managed to get into an area in between two military establishments. One's called Lark Hill and the other one's called Rolleston. And I was parked just up the lane on the edge of the Salisbury Plain by Rolleston. And that's also close to a Neolithic site dating back about 6,000 years ago called Robin Hood's Ball. And Robin Hood's Ball is a causeway enclosure, which is a bit like a henge monument. That's a ditch and a bank, but with gaps in it. And that's 6,000 years old. And that the red flag saying you can't turn right was flying right by that place. So that was my first transmission, and I'm now about sort of a 1.5 miles away from Stonehenge. That was the first transmission, which I managed to put out. But then the military police asked me to move on. So after the transmission, I then had to drive closer to Stonehenge and up a trackway, which is literally parallel to the monument and the only trackway left that the general public can get near Stonehenge. And English Heritage want to close that off.
Mm.
So we're hoping very much that does not get closed off at all. So I managed to get very close to Stonehenge itself and did another transmission from there as well. And all the time I was recording on another device so that we could have the recordings. But when I got to Stonehenge, it was very strange because you used to seeing a lot of people at Stonehenge at the weekend, and it was, you know, nobody was there apart from a few security guards. And it had a kind of very peaceful energy about it. So Stonehenge felt quite different because normally it's a very powerful place that can literally take you somewhere, give you a download. It's a high frequency place, and it seemed to be quite calm on that day compared to other days. And I've been visiting the monument for nearly 30 years, so I know Stonehenge, you know, very, very well.
Would you say this was maybe attributable to the lack of tourists?
Yes, I think that could be one part of it. But Stonehenge itself, you know, acts as Stonehenge with or without people. And it seemed to be, sometimes it goes into like high frequency mode, then it can drop down a little bit. As most stone circles and monuments do, they have their own cycles within cycles.
So they're responding to the background changes in our model of the hyperdimensional physics.
Yes, I think that they do, very much so.
So when we bring Thomas on, I'm going to have him compare your recordings from this effort on the 20th to your early transmission and recordings on the 4th, because your being more distant seemed to really help in terms of being able to detect signals, as opposed to a kind of an enormous rush of almost overwhelming energies. And when Tom comes on, I will have him describe that. So it was windy, very, very windy. You're in your car. You're not even able to get outside the car, right, to do all this?
No, because the wind was, I mean, it was horrendous. In fact, nobody would go with me. My friend said, we're not going out in that wind, Maria. The trees were coming down. So, I mean, to get there and back was really something. I mean, I asked a couple of guys I know, and they said, we're staying in, you're crazy.
Well, we kind of know that, but that's what makes you so lovable, because you're crazy like a fox. I mean, boy, talk about intrepid. Okay, so let me move over to David, because what I find really interesting is we've got three separate analysts who are looking at this data through three separate lenses, and they don't talk to each other before they get their results, and then they talk to each other and compare notes, and we post as much as we can on the site if it's a fit within the, you know, time frame of the program. And obviously this is why we're going to be doing this in two parts, part one tonight and part two tomorrow night, because we have a lot of detail to talk about. But what's so interesting from your responses, David, is that you told me earlier in the week, and when you had a chance to look, and I should also say we had other people with their radio, same model radio, wired into recorders or, you know, being recorded on smartphones, so that when Maria transmitted from Stonehenge, we would see if this ancient sacred site network all over the planet, places that we could cover, would respond with some kind of a resonance. In other words, whether we would get signals. And then we had some people like myself who, I don't think I'm near a sacred site. I'm about 90 miles from Chaco Canyon, but there's a caveat because I'm only maybe four or five miles from the Sandia Peaks. And up there appear to be some very ancient geometric structures that actually look as if they had been made by some very ancient, now totally vanished civilization many, many, many years ago. And when we get to John's research, we're going to talk about another area on the North American continent where something similar appears to have taken place. And so I can't really say categorically that I'm not within the field of an ancient solid state amplifying technology, i.e. a sacred site made of stone, you know, created by, you know, a long vanished culture. And that's not helping me amplify and record what I'm getting on the radio here. But be that as it may, we've got David, who is in Eastern British Columbia. We've got me down here in the land of enchantment, not far from the Sandias. We're going to have them on the show tomorrow night. Dennis Stone was recording at America's Stonehenge. And then a new member of our team, a longtime friend of Maria's, who goes by the handle Ra, and he will describe to us how he got that nickname. He was recording at the site of an ancient balanced rock in Upper New York State, and he got some very interesting results. Keith was recording, Keith Morgan, who is with us. I forgot to introduce him at the top of the show because he's with us every show. He's our IT and computer expert and signals guy, because he's worked with audio and radio for decades when he worked with ABC News and Ted Koppel. He recorded on his radio in Crofton, Maryland, which is many miles from downtown Washington, D.C., and the active, incredibly modern hyperdimensional structure known as the Washington Monument. He recorded during Maria's explorations separately there outside of D.C. and has sent those to the analysts. So hopefully we'll be able to report on his results either tomorrow or probably next week, because this is an ongoing deepening exercise. And we're certainly hoping among our listening audience, if there are people out there with cryptographic backgrounds, with signal analysis backgrounds, with people who write code, who develop algorithms that can look through a whole bunch of transmissions and look for commonalities and patterns, we would appreciate your input absolutely starting, you know, tomorrow morning, because we need more people with more creative abilities to focus on some extraordinary responses. And Clint Eastwood said in Dirty Harry, a man has got to know his limitations. Well, our limitations are funding and expertise, and we need more of both. So if you go to The Other Side of Midnight and you want to donate something to this ongoing effort, it would be very appreciated. So let me now turn to David, because David, I want you to describe your mode of analysis and then some of the really, to me, hot button things you got from your first cut looking at Maria's transmissions as she recorded them right outside the monument two Sundays ago.
So Maria, what was your transmission frequency, or did you use 432 and 144.1 on the 20th of February?
432.
Okay, so something incredible has happened on my radio ever since you transmitted. My radio, I've had this radio for 9 months and 8 or 9 months, and it has never stopped transmitting at 432 since you transmitted. In fact, I'll turn on right now, and this is 432. And it's constant. And inside of that apparent squelch are numbers. And I'm going to kind of go backwards here, because the invasion of Ukraine by Russia was February 24th. It's a miracle that you were transmitting 4 days before. And what happened on the 26th of February, I sent this message out to you, Maria, Keith, and Richard. I keep getting this number on my frequency meter, 1697.62, which happens to be the square root of two royal cubits. And again, two royal cubits is found in over 16 places in the Great Pyramid. And I thought, why do they keep pointing me to the Great Pyramid, to the Great Pyramid? What does the Great Pyramid have to do with Stonehenge? Now, my new data from the analysis of your frequencies, Maria, there's one section of the recording where I've got my meter in front of the recording, and I keep seeing.
So, David, hang on. For people who are new to this, you got to start from square one. How are you analyzing the signals? Be detailed.
Okay, the way I analyze the signals, you go to theothersideofmidnight.com. And scroll down to David's items.
Or you can click on David under fast links.
Okay, so let me just show you an example. And I want you to go to item two. And this is so shocking. Click on item two. This is a new breakthrough in our analysis method. And when you click on item two.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
Oh, my God, David.
But why did I keep getting – so the number on the bottom left, 29.9799, it was solid on Maria – when I was playing her frequencies, I've never seen my meter do this. It stayed there for a solid 10 or 15 seconds, whereas normally the numbers are jumping around all over the place.
So they're flickering past, and you have to video record them, play it frame by frame to catch these numbers.
Exactly what I'm doing. So I take my video camera on my iPad in front of my phone, which is running Frequency Meter Pro accurate to 2 decimals, and I'm putting my frequency meter in front of my speakers playing back Maria's recording. Now, the fact that I got the Great Pyramid again and again and again, and I said, why is it that I keep getting the Great Pyramid? And I realized...
Now, wait. You made a leap. You got to connect with people that may not see the graph. Not everybody is on a computer or on a phone that can look
at this. Okay, so what shows up on my meter are the numbers for the north latitude of the Great Pyramid. Now, I've seen these numbers before, and they are the same as the speed of light in metric, in kilometers per second. All you have to do is move your decimal over, because the number you're seeing, the decimal is not in the correct position. But they're the same numbers. So it's noted that when you go onto Google Earth, you can do this right now, and you switch your degrees, minutes, and seconds to digital, 10 base, and the location of the Great Pyramid of Egypt to a T is 29.9799 is the north face of the Great Pyramid precise.
29.9799 degrees north latitude.
Is the exact north latitude of the Great Pyramid. Notice that the Great Pyramids, I want you to see it in a completely different way, and this is the insight that came to me. Think of the Eye of Ra and the Eye of Horus. Think of the Great Pyramid, literally the Great Seal of the United States on the back of the $1 bill is the eye above the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Now think of it as an electronic eye, because it's pointing straight into Kiev and the entire conflict, like it's reading the whole thing.
Well, hang on. We made a leap here, because if you compare the decimal latitude of the Great Pyramid, 29.9799 degrees, instead of reading, you know, seconds and minutes of arc,
you basically
take it as a decimal, 29.9799. Mm-hmm. Then you look at David's inset photo on the Google map right beside it, and that number that hung out for several seconds, 10, 15, 20 seconds, 299799, obviously the frequency was telling you, screaming at you, the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, so now think of the way radar works. So if I want to take a radar reading of how far a jet is from my radar dish, because radar travels at the speed of light and it bounces back, it'll tell me how far away it is. Notice the image on the right meter reading from Maria's data, which follows the reading on the left, is the exact distance in kilometers between the Great Pyramid and the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant.
What?
Yeah, 1906. I did this on Google Earth, so I got right in there. And I on Google Earth, I typed in the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, and then I put my marker there and dragged myself back to the apex of the Great Pyramid of Egypt, and it is exact.
Wow.
So what that – and, of course, this is before
– This is 4 days before Putin has entered the country.
But 4 days before he entered the country, and – Again, it's almost
and weeks
like,
before, you know, it's what, 2 weeks, give or take, before he actually had troops enter the grounds of that nuclear plant a couple nights ago.
Yeah, right. So I'm seeing the Great Pyramid a whole other way now, because I found another number, but I can't give this number out because I got another number in Maria's data. And if I add it to the location of the Great Pyramid, it takes me somewhere else in the battlefield. And I won't give this location out. And the fact that I got two, and I'm not even through all her numbers yet.
Wait, hang on. You lost me. Why won't you give this number out?
Because it's too secure. It has to do with a very sensitive military operation. I'm not going to give it out.
Oh, okay.
All I can tell you is, okay, let's go back to this. Now go to my item one.
Okay.
Click on item one. Now this is taking, these are numbers that if you look at the meter reading in the middle, you're going to see the Zephyr Frisia nuclear power plant in the little red icon. And you're going to see these are Latin longs in two different readings, 47.4665 and 34.4923 is the square root of the numbers you see on my meter readings coming out of Maria's Stonehenge response. So 225307, the square root is 4746. So those Latin longs put me where my white dot is, and what I'm saying is that is probably the location prior to the attack of the nuclear power plant where Putin set up his troops to get ready to invade.
Well, if I remember the video and where the tracer shells were coming from, they were coming from the southwest, like from your location.
Right. So they would have moved from this. They would have had an encampment.
Guys, we loop out of break.
Okay. I'm okay. Gosh.
Okay. Let's do the break and then I'll continue when we get back. Cause this
excellent.
Is my boy.
Excellent. This is absolutely mind boggling. You know, it's kind of like the only thing you can say. So as we're, you know, recurringly looking at these messages, we're looking at 2 weeks warning on Tonga. We'll talk about that in some detail in a few minutes. And now we're looking at about 2 weeks warning on the Russian invasion of this major nuclear plant and a 4-day warning on the invasion of Ukraine. Who is talking to us out of time and trying to give us a heads up about events which are going to change the world? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, March 5th, 2022. As you can tell, the reason that a lot of us are so captivated by the responses we're getting is because the responses are literally off the edge of the paper. If you put a list of items 1 to 10 that you'd expect from an attempted ET transmission and reception experiment, you would not expect reception weeks ahead of time that would predict in the numbers two major catalytic events on planet Earth within literally weeks. And we have the data, and the data is real. If we can understand why they're sending this to us, what we can do about it, and who we're talking to. Okay, David, please continue.
Okay, so let's go back to my item one, because previously to my new discovery, which is the seeing the Great Pyramid as the eye, the all-seeing eye, and think of each slope, so the north slope of the Great Pyramid, the north face, which is where the entrance is facing straight up. If I go straight up, I'll pass right through the right of Kiev. And then if I go on the east face or the west face or the south face of the pyramid, think of it as a kind of photosensitive diode transmitter receiver, because it makes no sense to me how precise this data is. So my previous method of decryption of numbers was taking square roots and cube roots and, you know, just basic forms of encryption on the numbers appearing on my frequency meter in response to the chirping or even what appears to be background static coming in on the radios. So what really amazed me again is that when I turned my radio on here after Maria's second transmission, I got locations all over Ukraine, and it was just Ukraine, and it was also the border of some of the neighboring countries. But I've been watching my radio every night give me Latin longs all over Ukraine. But then when you asked me, Richard, to just analyze Maria's data, I was so shocked first to see this little white spot show up where you can imagine, you know, his troops coming in from the south, from the Black Sea, maybe parking their ships and then moving their way up and establishing a base camp where my white dot is. But my item two is so precise, if you understand how radar returns work at the speed of white, that the distance between the north face of the Great Pyramid and the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Remember, this is the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. And believe me, I know nuclear power plants inside out because I worked for major nuclear physicists and nuclear scientists on nuclear fusion and nuclear engineering. I knew Glenn Seaborg, who chaired the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. And we also knew MIT scientists who were nuclear power plant engineers. So I know how these things work. And first of all, they're supposed to be able to survive the impact of a 747 without even phasing the concrete dome structure of the plant. But we don't know if they could withstand a 7,000-mile-an-hour Russian Zircon missile, which Putin so far has not used. But all that aside, this data is coming in 4 days before the first day of the invasion. So that would mean, how did the pyramid – I'm starting to believe that where we're getting our data from is actually the pyramid. And the reason I believe that is it keeps sending me pyramid numbers. Like when it sent me this week
– Well, when you say from the pyramid, see, I would look at the pyramid as a transducer, that it was built to be a communications device between 3D reality and a hyperdimensional reality. It's a huge, all the
exactly.
Pyramids are huge machines. And I've measured other pyramids and Stonehenge and other sacred sites with the Accutron. And I know that these energies are changing the physical constants, like there is this bleed through between a higher dimensional reality and 3D reality. So I would not say the pyramid is doing it. I would say the pyramid is a focal point relay for whatever intelligence is talking to us, which I think, given the fact that we're looking at things out of time and anticipating by weeks in terrestrial metrology, it's literally out of time and trying to give us a heads up for critical events that are going to change the history of the planet. Nothing less.
Well, if you look at like the description, the Eye of Ra is a being in ancient Egyptian mythology that functions as the feminine counterpart to the sun god Ra and a violent force that subdues his enemies. The eye is an extension of Ra's power. And then you go into to the idea of this is in a really good description of this. I actually found this on Wikipedia, that one of the eyes of Horus, which is similar to the Eye of Ra. So Ra is the chief sun god in Egyptian mythology, right? So Horus is the son of Isis. So Horus's eye
and Osiris.
His left eye is equated to the moon, and his right eye is equated with the sun. And of course, Stonehenge is a lunar calendar, and would that mean the pyramid is a solar, reflector? So how am I getting data like this? Why, like on the 26th of February, I got the square of two royal cubits multiple times on my radio here. Plus, I was getting locations all over the battlefield in the Ukraine. I mean, right. I mean, I've got data. I've got numbers that take me right into the middle of Kiev, the city, right? So that means, why aren't I getting numbers all over the freaking planet? Why is it all week? I can turn my radio on and put my meter in front of it and get lat and longs all over this field, this theater of war. And that means it's like the pyramid is acting as the Eye of Horus or the Eye of Ra, and it's collecting data. And you're right. A higher dimensional perspective would be the sun and or the moon itself, if it's an intelligentsia that is a living system. But somehow it's using that as a reflective focal point, because when I look on my item two, this number, 1976-37, shows up after the 29.9799 number. And what prompted me to do this was I'm saying, why do they keep giving me pyramid numbers? And I just decided to measure the distance between the power plant and the pyramid. And I did this multiple times because I couldn't believe it when I got my number. And my number is accurate to 99.99%, by the way. So, and I don't know how accurate this measuring tool. So if you go on Google Earth,
it's very accurate. It's certainly,
there's a measuring tool.
It's certainly within two significant figures.
Right. So I can zoom right in on the power plant, and there's multiple domes on that power plant. It's got like, I mean, I don't have it right in front of me zoomed in, but I can tell you it is one of the biggest nuclear power plants. I mean, I've been inside of nuclear power plants. I mean, I know how they work. And
well, it supplies about a quarter of Ukraine's total energy. Now,
yeah,
in,
so
when hang on. When Georgia joined us in the third hour, you know, we're going to spend the first 2 hours looking at data and looking at decoding and all that. Third hour, we're going to talk about interpretation. What the hell is going on, and what can it mean in the big, big picture? And I've done some thinking about Putin and Ukrainian nuclear reactors, NATO, and all that. I think this is why this is a focal point of intense interest, including whomever we're talking to.
Yeah, so for people who don't know in your audience, I'm Ukrainian. Sarita just means Wednesday in Ukrainian. My grandparents on my father's side are both pure Ukrainians and probably Ukrainian Jews who turned to Catholics to hide from the Jewish persecution under Stalin. And on my mother's side, I'm English and French and Irish and all that stuff. So I know a lot about the Ukraine through family, but we don't have to go into the politics so much. Is I'm really blown away by this, Richard, because I, like I said, I got a second location in Maria's data. This isn't in my separate data on my radio. In Maria's data, there's another distance between the pyramid and another very profound target in this theater of war. And that target needs to be protected, in my opinion. I could tell you off air, Richard, what it is. But it showed up on the frequency meter as well. So that means I have a whole new set of data analysis to do, which is looking at my numbers and measuring points off the Great Pyramid to an event or something.
Well, the next thing in your research I would expect in the next week you'll be able to do is look at the location of Ukraine's other nuclear power plants, because nuclear energy supplies about half of Ukraine's total electrical energy budget, and see if they fall out of the data the way this one did.
Yeah, that's a great idea, and I know
Okay, I want to come back to some other decoding, but I'd like to go to John, because I want to broaden our focus. John, you and I have discussed about other examples of this kind of communication, which frankly in the major media has been popularized as how you would talk to aliens, or how you would talk to someone who's not, as Michael Hill said, not from here.
Yes. Yeah, we have Close Encounters. You like to use that a lot. And Maria's Stonehenge recording reminded me of Close Encounters. Toward the end there, the humans are playing, and then the aliens go, wah, wah. I had just another psychic synchronicity or metaphysical message, whatever you want to call it. All humans get these. You just have to be open to them. I started working on Balanced Rock last summer after Keith showed some images. But I've got about 200 hours into this and collected 30 hours of footage from people visiting
there,
there
are several features on Earth called Balanced Rocks, because there's a lot of rocks that are balanced.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. And
this is the one in Utah, and the one that Maria's friend, is going to talk about tomorrow night is in upper New York State. And it's not exactly balanced. It's sitting on three other rocks, kind of like a tripod. And how it got there and who put it there and is it a natural erosional event? I mean, these are all questions I'm going to ask Ra tomorrow night. But you're talking about the ones in Utah.
In the Utah Swell, yes. It's right next to Canyonland State Park, which is where the monolith appeared a couple of years ago. So this is in a small area. And I've been visiting the West since I was a boy, and I always had the same feeling that Keith did, that there's all these monuments along the Colorado River. And I actually set my book, Old Souls, is set up in Montana, where I say that the Martians escaped Mars and they landed in Montana long ago. And this was a couple of weeks. I get up from a nap and I sit down and put on the TV. I don't watch much TV, but it comes on to the Comet TV, and it's a scene from a movie I saw like 20 years ago at the theater, Mission to Mars. And
the one by De Palma.
By De Palma.
Brian De Palma, the brother of the physicist, the hyperdimensional physicist that I was good friends with, Bruce De Palma, who is no longer with us, unfortunately.
Yeah, so it was just another, I watched that scene, I'm like, geez, that's just what we're doing. And they show the alien mother, and that goes right with my hypothesis that Utah, it's not erosion, there's nothing balanced. This was all type 2 civilization from Mars. There's several races of Martians depicted in all these monuments. The monuments go on for hundreds of square miles, and then all up the Rocky Mountains up into Canada. So this is a huge deal. But I'm just focusing right now on the Utah Swell. But Richard, I didn't know about, you said there was a backstory to Brian De Palma, and I don't know anything about that. Do you want to?
Well,
if
Brian De Palma apparently convinced NASA to be a technical institutional advisor to his movie Mission to Mars, and the idea was kind of put out there, the trailer, whatever, is that this is going to be a hyper realistic movie about NASA's plans to go to Mars, land on Mars, land habitats, send the crew to rendezvous with the habitats, do research and all that. And instead, it turns out that they have to go and rescue a previous mission, which has disappeared under very bizarre circumstances. So NASA was heavily involved in the planning and development and shooting of a lot of mission to Mars. And then, like on the eve of the premiere, De Palma leaves the United States, because normally the way these things work is the producer and director do a whole dog and pony show on television. They visit all the networks. They visit, Hollywood magazines and, columnists. And they basically showcase the movie. The stars do the same thing. And it's basically publicity that the studio needs to get audiences into the seats in the theaters, right? Just before the movie's going to premiere, De Palma splits for France and does not come back for years. And when NASA is asked about formally its participation in the shooting of the film, NASA pretends, according to their official public relations spokespersons, that they had zero involvement with the film, even though it's on record that they were heavily involved in helping him with all kinds of shooting and technologies and technical plans and rocket ship designs and all that. So nobody wanted to discuss Brian De Palma's movie, Mission to Mars. Why? Because the central focus of the mission is a visit to Cydonia and going into the face on Mars and discovering that it's a monument to an ancient Martian race that, after a catastrophe on Mars, came to Earth, seeded the Earth with organisms, including the what would develop into the human race.
And that's what the Utah Swell seems to be, a monument to some huge event with all of these animals and tons of monuments to these Martians. I believe they are Martians. And I think that's what we're looking at.
Which is why this bizarre monolith, a couple of years ago suddenly appearing, being very hyperdimensional, being tetrahedral, being, a two-dimensional version of a 3D tetrahedron located in a canyon with all kinds of extraordinary images, three-dimensional images all over the walls that Keith, first noticed and pointed out to me. And then I took the monument seriously and figured out the numbers. And again, it was basically an ET message in a three-dimensional artifact on the surface of this planet, just like Cydonia is a mathematical message on the surface of Mars surrounding a face-like effigy, which is over a mile in length and 1,500 feet high. So there appears to be this connection between mathematics and communication. And why are we all here? And are we in fact talking to the descendants of our own ancient progenitors or ancestors? And are we talking not just between places in 3D in the solar system and beyond, but are we talking to somewhere beyond time and space in a hyper dimension that can see the future and is wanting to somehow help us avoid what might be coming?
And as you can see in my image 4, there are many alignments, solar alignments. I imagine there are probably lunar alignments too, but I can't figure out how to use Google Earth yet to chart the lunar alignments. But there are obvious solar alignments, especially with Delicate Arch, which is just north of Balanced Rock here. Very Indiana Jones kind of, the sun coming up and shining and hitting the thing and it reflects down on it and the thing opens. I mean, it's Indiana Jones squared.
Okay, moving on to our current research, which is the signals themselves. Where did you dive in?
I dove in because after listening to these signals for a while, you begin to isolate the sounds, and isolated five or six sounds, and they seem to be coming from the radio. The computer beeps, a klaxon sample I have there, metronome, projector. This is just names I'm applying to these sounds.
Now, are these in Maria's recordings?
Good question. Maria's recordings confirmed the sounds, but they were much louder, and the quiet tones were much quieter. The first thing I noticed about...
No. I'm asking what your source data is. Where are you...
The source data is from your recordings.
Really important. Okay.
December 25th. I mean, there's a lot of hours, and so you start hearing these different elements. And, you know, like the other week, we had frequency mode and, you know... So we're hearing these radio sounds, and I think it would behoove us to contact, like I could contact the radio manufacturer, say, hey, we're getting this. And Keith, because last night I was talking to Keith on a Skype call, and I noticed there's a two tones playing in the background that keep repeating, and she says, and it just keeps repeating. And I said, Keith, what is that sound? And I had my speakers up a bit loud. It's kind of irritating after a while. And he says that's from his USB headset, and he hears that in the background. I think it'd be cool if he contacted that manufacturer, and then we could compare their responses and just apply it to our analysis to see, is it the chirps coming in that is activating the electronics in the radio and causing these sounds to play, or is it something in the radio? So I just want to either eliminate or confirm, or, you know, why are we getting these radio sounds that kind of muddy up what we're doing? You know, we don't need those sounds. We want to hear the chirps. So that's where I am. And then when I got Maria's recording, first thing I noticed was the lack of background noise. It's just super quiet. It's like silent during the pauses. Whereas your recordings, Richard, you know, there's this background hiss. And I noticed the attack for tomorrow night. I have some attack and decay comparisons, which is the sound leading up to the chirp and the chirp fading out is the decay. And you, on your recordings, Richard, you have a specific, you know, there's a pattern in the attack and decay of the chirps. And then you look at Maria's recording, and aside from being like turned up to 11, you know, this one goes up to 11. the attack and decay is microseconds. It's like 1,000ths of a second. It's so short compared to the long attack and decay of your recordings, Richard. Hers, it's just so quick and loud, like boom. It's, you know, they're so incredibly amplified through Stonehenge. So very interesting. Those were the first kind of things I noticed.
Okay, we are at the bottom of the hour. Pause there, because when we come back, we're going to go to Thomas Mathers, and Thomas has got some really fascinating new data, and I guarantee you it's going to blow your mind. I mean, all of this blows my mind, because there were people before we started all this that said, you won't get anything, and, you know, you won't be able to interpret it. And what to me is important is this is convergent. We're looking at data which is converging, and we'll explain what we mean by that when we return. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We're discussing our ongoing experiments in ET communication. And I use that term broadly because anything beyond the Earth's reference frame, even if it is hyperdimensional, would by definition extraterrestrial. We shall return. Thank you.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to The Other Side of Midnight for this Saturday night. Greeting in the next half hour into Sunday morning here on the land, on The Other Side of Midnight in the Land of Enchantment. I want to turn now to Thomas Mathers. Thomas has a background as an award-winning producer. He has led bands. He has traveled the world. He has experienced the technologies of ancient sacred sites and the non-technological human experience of being in these places and resonating with them as a kind of a human antenna system. And he's got some pretty interesting results. So without further ado, Thomas, it's your turn in the circle.
Hello.
Good evening, or good morning.
Good evening. Yeah, so I thought sort of an interesting way to sort of start this before I jump into kind of the items would be to actually explain to people what was sent out. So as the project's been progressing and as we've been putting out the subsequent transmissions, you know, we've been taking some of the information that we're receiving and then, you know, kind of, you know, trying to modify and sort of evolve the signal that's going out. So this last round, the Stonehenge transmissions basically have been some different types of sound frequencies, tones, and things using sine waves. You know, and the reasoning and basis behind this was this is a way for us to be able to, in a very simple way, be able to send pretty accurate numbers, mathematical ratios, and encode it into the signal that's going out.
And initially, we sent on two frequencies, 144.1 megahertz and 432, and we decided on this session, this second Stonehenge foray, to limit it basically to 432.
Yeah, so I think there seemed to just kind of be a little bit more energy and response around the 432 this time around, and certainly in the data that we've received back, that seems to have been a good decision. But back to the signal that's gone out. The signal that Maria broadcasted contained sort of 9 core elements here. So the first element was basically shooting out the 7 sacred frequencies. This is related to the different frequencies connected to different chakras. And then that led into Stonehenge coordinates, and we repeated that 3 times. And then following that was the golden ratio, and then following that was pi, which keep that kind of in mind because that is something that comes back to us. Number 5 is the E constant, Number six is the square root of 3. The seventh component is the Pyramid of Giza coordinates, which is repeated 3 times with 2 different octaves in the tone. And then the number 8 was we incorporated this time around Mars's diameter and pi. So again, we're looking at pi. And then finally, the Morse code alphabet. And the reason behind that is, so in the last couple of weeks, we've taken some of these rhythmic, components to the transmissions that we've received. And not necessarily thinking that there's going to be some super accurate structure in terms of us receiving Morse code, but it was really sort of done initially as an attempt to be able to analyze the sound data in a different way and see if we're finding any kind of repeating pattern. The general sort of thing that we've been able to see here is that the radios on these frequencies, when they're kind of listening normally, tend to sort of vary sort of behavior, and their behavior varies. But a lot of the time they tend to be very quiet. And then sort of during the lead ups and then after a transmission goes out, this is where the activity really starts kind of getting more energetic, which is, you know, definitely indicative that we're tapping into something. Now, one of the big takeaways from the experiment that we've been able to see right now is that there definitely is a correlation to the type of behavior of the radios when these transmissions are going out. And this does not seem to be necessarily affected by geography. There definitely seems to be an effect on the amplitude of the transmission that's coming back, the resolution, which I'll kind of get to when I start going through some of the items. This is kind of my interpretation, like the resolution of the transmission that's coming back. But the behavior of the radios has been shown to be consistent. So we're triggering some type of an event. No matter what ends up happening or any other takeaways from this, as far as I'm concerned, that's, you know, it's a success for us in terms of the experiment. So going into the items, I mean, what I wanted to do, and I think I'm just scrolling over to my items here. So I've got a couple of pictures that people can go to. And again, for listeners out there, you can go to theothersideofmidnight.com and go to tonight's show. And if you scroll down to the hyperlink for Thomas's items, you'll be able to follow along and actually see some of the images here.
Well, you can also click on Fast Links, which is under the banner on the guest page. That will take you directly to Thomas's section.
Exactly. So there was this time around, I guess, where do we begin here? When we compare what we received and what Maria was recording from the first Stonehenge transmission attempt, where there seemed to have been some interesting kind of behavior in terms of battery drainage, what we were able to analyze, okay, in the audio, the one sort of characteristic that we could, give to it was that it was very intense. The first Stonehenge transmission, when she was, you know, right in the heart of it, what we were receiving was just like, I mean, it sounded like being in like a wind tunnel or something. It was very bizarre. There was kind of like almost a helicopter noise, you know, big swirling, but everything was extremely energetic. Is very unusual, because of some of the technical issues related to the batteries, we didn't have a substantial amount of time to be able to analyze specifically from Maria's recording equipment. This time around, because she was a little bit geographically further away from the site.
Yeah, hang on, Maria. How far were you from Stonehenge at the closest point this time?
I was about, when I got close to Stonehenge, probably about 250 feet away from Stonehenge, 200,
250. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The second
time. So now, yeah, so I mean, the interesting thing is that you can hear this swirling, the helicopter noise. I mean, it's this kind of the signal that came back. Is
I mean, it almost sounds like you're describing, and I wish we could play it for people.
Well, we're going to.
I call it the projector sound. That's my projector.
Yeah. So.
Oh, hang on. Well, let's go listen, because it's radio, folks.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yes.
You know, I'm being so
exactly.
frustrated.
So,
because remember, this is like, you know, nobody compares notes until we actually come together. So there is some overlap here. Let me get to John's and let me go down.
Well, no. If you go to my line item number 5, there's
number
a link to
five.
SoundCloud. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a playlist. And we've got a whole bunch of different things that we can play from in here. These relate back to some of the links in here actually relate back to some of the items that we're going over. So
you want me to click on it and play what background? What this vortex?
Yes, this is a playlist. So there's 18 items in there. We don't have to play them all. They're all labeled, so I can kind of give you a little bit of a guidance as to what to play. But if you go to the SoundCloud link.
Yeah, I'm there. I'm just looking for the background, this wishing vortex you described.
Well, that's going to be in all of this stuff, because this was kind of a common feature in Maria's recordings. Again, this is kind of like the richness in what we're getting back and what we're analyzing from Maria's compared to the stuff that is coming into your radio and David's radio and some of the other people. I mean, what we're seeing is that these geographical locations, in terms of being in proximity of different energetic ley lines or the sacred sites themselves, you know, do definitely seem to be, you know, as we were, I think, initially kind of looking to test if they would act as like kind of like a natural signal amplifier, both on the signal going.
So
out.
Which one should I play that reflects the background you're describing?
I mean, you can start by playing so maybe not number 1, because that was a Morse. You can try playing item number 2.
All right. Here's an item number 2. It says Maria Rhythmic. Okay.
Yes.
The 12-minute mark.
Oh, actually, wait. Let me just maybe play number 11.
Going to 11. Okay. Weird pulse repeated. Okay. I was kind of looking at that myself. Okay, let's hope this works. This is what the raw data sounds like. Wow, that is not radio as I've ever heard it.
No.
I call them stone beats, Richard. Stone beats and stone tones.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, the thing is
you weren't banging on those monoliths, were you, Maria?
No.
No, you didn't get closer than 200 feet. Okay. So go ahead.
Just one moment. I was opposite, exactly. I positioned myself along that track to be opposite the vortex where Richard got his spike.
The Accutron readings back in 2011.
That's right. So I positioned myself to be in opposition to that.
Yeah,
this almost sounds mechanical.
I think that's a timing device inside the radio.
No.
No?
No, it would be up in the... You wouldn't hear it.
Okay, so if you just press pause for a second, Richard.
Okay.
I mean, just explain to people. So we had, in this attempt, there wasn't as much kind of intensity. So we were able to sort of see a lot more texture in this kind of chaotic noise. Okay. Now, in my experience, you know, I'm not really hearing too much that would be kind of similar to traditional like radio static, stuff that would be kind of more related to kind of like a pink or white noise type of sound. We had about 140 minutes worth of recordings. And so my approach with this in kind of decoding it or just attempting to get my head wrapped around this was quite literally to sit down and listen to this from start to finish. So I listened to 250.
Kind of like Jodie Foster on the hood of the Pontiac.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, you know, took a listen to this straight in one sitting. And now the thing is that, like, as you kind of get into this, you know, I kind of joked with you guys after the fact. I was sort of saying, like, you know, I hope this is safe. You know, I didn't want to sort of get something, you know, downloaded. And my wife certainly, you know, had a bit of a chuckle when she kind of saw me just kind of sitting there listening to hours of what she would interpret as static. But here's the thing. There seems to be kind of different motifs, and there's a definite palette. And what I mean by resolution is that there's just a lot more texture to the signals that's coming in here than what we're getting from sort of a radio that's just positioned somewhere that's further away from an energetic line. So we're definitely seeing and hearing that, you know, in the signal, this like lushness. And as I kind of got into this, you know, these are with trained ears. I mean, for people out there, I've been producing music since the 90s. I've got extremely trained ears for basically dissecting mixed audio. You know, it's a skill that you need to kind of fine-tune to become a good music producer. So I can listen to pretty much any type of music, any type of sound, and I can kind of, you know, instead of visually dissecting it, I'm audio based dissecting it and can kind of focus my attention onto different areas, which is obviously important for the mixing process when you're producing music. So as this was going on, I'm you know, and this was just so much more rich than anything we've had up until this point. This is by far just some of the most amazing sort of evidence and data that we've had to work with. I mean, it was really, you know, once I got into this, it was really quite impressive. Now, you know, what John was talking about in terms of this rhythmic structure, because, you know, after we both had sort of independently analyzed this, we were able to kind of reconnect and sort of compare some notes. And we both agreed that there was just some points here that, like, you know, there was almost like a real rhythmic structure that, again, with my skilled and trained ears, didn't feel it did feel kind of organic and somewhat natural, not so much mechanical, but it was very musical. You know, where after you're listening to this, and then all of a sudden, like, there's a cohesiveness that comes together, and you're like, wow, like, this is, like, actually kind of, like, coming together. And then the thing is that, like, you'll sort of have these, like, energetic bursts that come in for, like, 20 minutes or 18 minutes, and then you'll just kind of have, like, a general sort of silence for a little bit. It's not like this is super continuous all the way through. The behavior is really, really, really strange. I mean, it's just not...
Guys, we're blowing through the break again.
No, I have 10 minutes of.
Oh,
unless my computer is... See, when Maria visited Stonehenge, Maria, on the first time, on the 4th, you were in the center of the monument, in the center of the vortex. If you can think of it as a hurricane centered invisibly on those circular, circumcircular stones, and your watch, you said, lost 15 minutes of time in the
yes.
hour or so that you were there.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the inside, the holiest of holies, by the altar stone, which is the near center, the most powerful place at Stonehenge, as in any stone circle, is the near center, never the geometric. That's where the ancients would put the central megalithic features, and it was there that was the most powerful, for sure.
Wow. Okay, so by being farther away, that overwhelming background that, Thomas, you've been describing, although we're still hearing it in what I guess John's calling the projector sound, it is lower, so the other modulations on top of that were more distinct. It wasn't drowned out in the background.
Well, this is what's so we're sort of, you know, building up to
well, let's play some more samples because kind of people love to hear this.
Yeah, so
pick
exactly.
one.
So I think because we're talking about this rhythmic structure.
Yeah.
I think if you did we play number 2 already?
No, we played 11. We played 11.
Yeah, so let's play number 2.
Right,
this is kind of this rhythmic kind of feeling that comes in. That's 12 minute mark on her recording.
Got it.
Yeah.
That's it?
Yep. These are highlighted sort
okay,
of.
Okay, let me
again.
Do it again. See,
okay,
I hear structure.
Just...
I hear with my untrained ear, even though I was a musician on Columbia Records, I hear two levels of structure. I hear the background, which is not random noise. There's a structure in that background. Then I hear a foreground. It's not pings. It's not musical. It's more like a staccato. Like someone's hitting a Coke bottle.
Coconut.
Yeah.
So
now
I wrote a coconut, you know.
Yeah. So if you go to... If you go to number 4 now, again, this is kind of a similar type of thing, this kind of rhythmic structure. This is what I kind of labeled it as, like ping pong. Again, like John and I are kind of just, you know, randomly sort of naming these sounds as to kind of what we can kind of relate them to. But there is a definitive palette. Like, it's not like there's a million different types of noises that we're pulling up.
Okay.
There seems to be kind of a couple of different categories.
All right, here is number 4, which you describe as ping pong. Okay.
Yeah, and this is between the 29th and 30th minute mark within her recording.
Okay. It sounds like something from the Caribbean.
I have this for tomorrow night.
There's a beat in there.
The drum beat.
Yeah,
there's a
beat.
It sounds, almost like a hyperdimensional calypso.
Come to the island.
Holy cow, guys.
So if you go to number 5, now this is my kind of interpretation, if you can just pause it before we play it.
Okay.
So this is, again, kind of like, so this last one that we played was at the 29 to 30th minute mark. This is going from the 30 minute 20 second mark, okay? So you're going to hear that kind of ping pong, that rhythmic calypso, the hyperdimensional calypso, and then the distortion that you're kind of hearing, to me, I kind of interpret this as like, it does sound like a kind of a voice, okay? Like very, very distorted. But I've ruled out, like, I can see in the recording when Maria has connected the radio, like when it's actually, she's put it into the jack, and you can see by the mono recording that this is coming straight from the radio. So there's nothing else polluting the digital recording into her digital recorder.
Hmm.
And after we've now kind of from the first attempt, because of just the intensity of her being very close to Stone, inside of Stonehenge, you know, we had her reduce the recording volume. So we had zero distortion. There's zero distortion on this. This is being recorded as you would want it at a good volume, you know, properly connected. So you can play this one. So you'll continue to hear this ping pong voice. And then I kind of call it like the data voice. It's just kind of how I interpreted the sound.
Okay, here is number five. Here is number five.
Like an old Geiger counter.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really quite strange. And then, so to continue this kind of little section before, because we're getting close to the bottom of the hour.
Yeah, we've got about 4 minutes here.
Yeah. So if we go into number six, this is now kind of shows you, this is kind of the ping pong sound that goes into the background and then to quiet. And then this is just kind of how this signal kind of evolves and sort of shifts and changes. It's really... it's fascinating, really.
Okay,
frankly.
Here's number six.
Anyway, yeah. Really hear the projector sounds in the background.
Yeah,
very, very faintly. Like it's not. That's the sound that was very, very, very up front when Maria was closer. So, I mean, it's very strange. So, I mean, I think, yeah.
Say what? Hold it there. We're trying to figure out a mystery, a cosmic mystery. We're listening to signals recorded by Maria Wheatley. 200 and some feet from Stonehenge on Sunday afternoon, February 20th, 2022. And there's all kinds of coding, from the numbers to the frequencies to the repetition to the hyperdimensional conga, calypso. Who are we in communication with? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall all return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to the other side of midnight for this Sunday night. I'm sorry, Saturday night into Sunday morning here in the Land of Enchantment. We're listening to Thomas Mather's decodings, frequency decodings, of Maria's recordings in the environs within around 250 feet of Stonehenge during a incredibly inclement British hurricane a couple weeks ago on the afternoon of the 20th. And unlike her first foray into the center of the storm on the 4th, the background, although present, this whirling, almost vortex sounding background, you can hear other modulations in front. You can hear pulses. You can hear frequency spacing. You can hear that there is intelligence communicating something. And as David has already shown us, these same recordings are spitting out frequencies like crazy, and those frequencies are incredibly meaningful, literally connecting, among other things, the impending invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and then subsequently in the same recordings, the connection between the Great Pyramid in Egypt and the Ukrainian nuclear reactor on the Dnipro River that was bombarded and assaulted and then taken over by the Russians just two nights ago. So, Thomas, pick it up, please.
Okay. So, again, like as I'm going through and I'm listening to this, you start getting acquainted with some of this palette. You sort of familiarize yourself with some of these, you know, projector sounds, helicopter type sounds, the whirling, swooshing. This is where things got weird. Because, you know, after
really? Everything up to now has been totally boringly normal,
yeah.
Right? Just this afternoon at Starbucks. Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, as I'm listening to it, you know, what we're looking for are, you know, is similar to how David is kind of working with his radios and analyzing his frequencies. We're analyzing the digital data and we're looking for frequency spikes, things that are going to kind of stand out. So, you know, it's not like looking for a needle in a haystack. I mean, once you kind of get accustomed to the sounds that you're hearing, you'll be able to hear when there's a tone, as long as it's within the human audio frequency range. So, you know, generally between 20 hertz and 20,000 hertz, which was actually that frequency sweep was something that we sent out the first transmission out of Stonehenge. That was a part of the signal. So anyways, the first time that I heard an isolated tone was at the 40-minute mark, 40-minute and 20-second mark of Maria's recording. And there was, I mean, I definitely could hear the tone. And then when I put it, when I put a spectrum analyzer to actually identify where the peak is, you can clearly see it. So if you, let me just see if I have it in the items. For this particular one, I don't. I've got it for the kind of the main, well, I've got it for the most important one. This is just the first, just keep in mind that it's not like we're getting, you know, 100 different tones coming in. I mean, we're talking about probably like four clearly identifiable tones over the course of 140 minutes of recordings. So this is not a common occurrence throughout this. This is why it stood out. So this was the first time that my attention kind of got piqued and I was like, what's that? And then I stopped and sort of analyzed it. So that's the link number 7 on the SoundCloud, which is the first frequency peak at 4.95 kilohertz. And again, that's at the 40-minute, 20-second mark.
Okay, so that's what this sounds like. All right.
Yeah.
Do this, and then I'll turn that up, and there's a lot of stuff to do here.
So you can hear it in the background, like the
not,
you know,
really. I got to be honest. I don't hear it.
If
let,
you
let me
if
try
you
it again.
Look at it in
Yeah. I hear it.
What I hear is okay. The background sounds like a machine gun, and then I hear yep. the pings or the, mm-hmm. the kind of Congo drum thingy. Let me listen again. Mm-hmm. I don't hear a tone.
I separated yep. the tones, which I have for tomorrow night's show, Richard, so you'll be able to hear them better.
Yeah. So the important thing, so again, this was just, it was the first time that I kind of noticed something a little bit different than what we had been hearing for the first 40 minutes. Now, oddly enough, this is where things get for me the weirdest, is that like about just after this section, I could have sworn that I heard a voice. And it was very quick, but it was... So, and when it happened, like literally the hairs stood up on my arms, and then I went back, and because we were sort of delayed with the show, I was able to really kind of go back in. I have ruled everything out. So I don't know if this is like, you know, some type of an electronic voice phenomenon. I don't know what it is. It's very short sort of syllable. Again, I kind of, when I heard this the first time, you know, I went and grabbed my wife and I said, hey, listen to this. You know, do you hear anything in it? And she clearly said, yeah, I hear a voice in the background. So this is item 8, 9, 10. So number 8, I've repeated the section 4 times. Okay, so you'll hear a little bit of a break between it so that you can hear it and look for the voice. The voice is kind of sitting in the background a little bit. The first one is, this is the unprocessed. So this is the raw sound that comes through.
See, we don't hear voices normally on any of these transmissions. The only voices we heard, we dismissed a couple weeks ago as triggers in the radio of a preset program. It's not in the radio.
Richard, for the 4th of February, I heard what I thought. When I heard it, I thought EVP. This is on February 4th, Maria's recording. I didn't say it to anyone on the team. I wanted to keep this independent and see if anybody else noticed it. I contacted someone from Paraflix who works with EVPs to see what they thought of it. And then on the 20th, I found 3 more. And then this past Tuesday, Tom and I got together on the phone. And when he said he thought he heard an EVP, I was like, bingo.
Let's play it here. Okay. Ready? Boy, you guys have good ears. I don't hear a thing.
I heard it, Thomas. I heard it. It's very faint, but I heard it.
Yeah, so
Let me try it again.
No, but just to make it easier for people, like I just want people to hear the original one.
Well, we just did that, so.
Yes, so if you go to number 9, this is processed. So
number
all I've done is I've just, yeah, number 9.
I'm thinking of Lily Tomlin. Number 9? Okay, here's number 9. Okay,
yes.
Ready? Here goes.
Okay, and I further process it in number 10. So what you should be looking for is in the back there, you can hear something that sounds like ray or gray, and it's like, and it sounds like, doesn't sound like a woman's voice. It, to me, sounded, I don't know. I mean, now knowing that, play number 10, and you'll hear it in the background. It's
okay,
lit,
here's
so
number 10, played 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, I got to tell you.
Oh, yeah, you can hear that.
I don't hear a thing.
Yeah.
I hear the machine gun.
Right.
Hang on. Don't pass over that. Because I have average ears. You know, if I'm not hearing it, how many in the audience are hearing it? Are we sure it's really on the recording, or is it triggering something in you, Thomas, and you, John, that's already in your own minds, and it's acting as a trigger as opposed to it's in the radio?
Like one thing that I want to kind of say here, like, you know, I've got extremely good ears when it comes to stuff like this. And I can tell you that after I
listen. Yeah, and I'm listening on $300 headphones that Art made me spend that much money to get. And I'm telling you, when I play it. I don't hear
like
any
it almost
voices.
Sounds like great. It almost like great, great, great. Like it's like
it's in
anyway,
the background, Richard. You can hear it. It's definitely there.
Yeah. Let me try it again. David, I'm glad you're hearing it because. Okay,
oh,
I might have heard. Maria, are you hearing it?
Yes, I can hear it.
Oh,
I think it's great or great. It's in between the noisy bit,
It's very
fleeting.
Short.
It's very fleeting.
And my cat can hear it, Richard. Come on.
Your cat? Oh, God. Well, I have educated mice. You have an educated cat. Okay. Let's try it one more time with feeling. Okay, I am, with repetition, I'm hearing great, 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 but
yes,
it's way under the noise.
I know, but here's the thing. I went back after hearing that, okay, and the tone of the voice.
God, you have amazing ears to hear that
I went back, and I listened to the entire recording again.
Georgia can hear it. Ah, I feel like the slow kid. In class.
Yeah. So I went back knowing what to look for to see if I could hear that coming through the transmission at any other point in the 140 minutes.
Right.
Nothing like that happens again. It's the only part in 140 minutes. It's just that little part. But that
there's three other EVPs I made note of, but none of them say great. They're different sounds.
Yeah, I mean, it's a short, unisyllable, syllable word. I mean, I wish it was a message, but I mean, it's definitely a voice.
And Richard, remember, you said yourself that Stonehenge is, opens up sort of a doorway or lifts the veil between the two worlds. So these could be EVPs.
So
well,
that's
exactly why Georgia, say hello to everybody, okay?
Hello, everybody.
Hi, Georgia.
Hello.
How come everybody can hear this more easily than I can? This is weird. Maybe I'm losing my hearing.
what it reminded me of are those technologies where you wear headphones and one sound is played in the right ear and one is in the left ear.
Right.
And entrain to something else. It's sort of like the fore noise and the background noise are kind of doing that.
I'm actually going to do a binaural comparison for next weekend, Georgia. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that in comparing what we're receiving to some type of a binaural beat, or that type of a binaural effect. The binaural effect requires a stereo signal, and we're recording mono. This is what's coming out of the radio is 100% a mono signal. So, I understand what you're saying, that it could potentially be some overlap, but this is not some type of an interference between a foreground and background noise. Like this is definitely a unique.
It's like somebody whispering in a hurricane.
Yeah.
Why didn't they want to make themselves more obvious?
Now,
hey, this is interesting, you guys. Ray in Hebrew means little lamb.
Oh, that's good.
As a phonetic word, Ray, is in ancient Hebrew, means little lamb.
Yeah, and the hi Ron, the Egyptian sun god, is it Ray or Ra?
Oh,
One.
Well, then Ray could relate to the Great Pyramid, to the anchor point of David's frequency analysis as a redundant second level.
Oh, my God, Richard. And, you know, I just, while we've been on the air, I found in Maria's data precise Great Pyramid to Chernobyl. Now, remember,
that
Putin
was the first place
Chernobyl.
That Putin took over.
That's it's exact, Richard. I mean, in kilometers. I'm going to do the graphic for tomorrow night. And I also got Pyramid to Kiev just south of the city, also in Maria's data. So the odds of this new technique that the pyramid is like the eye of Ra or Ray, and it's giving me distances in kilometers from the pyramid to the targets.
And John, by metonymy, the Great Pyramid, ancient Egyptian civilization, connections to Mars.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, as we kind of, you know, again, like, you know, as I'm continuing to listen to this, I mean, the voice definitely was something that kind of spooked me. I mean, it was exciting to finally hear something.
I'm spooked that you heard the damn thing.
What's the phonetic, proper phonetic for the Egyptian god Ra? Maybe it's Re, Re.
Well, we don't know. There's nobody around that speaks ancient Egyptian.
No, there is some controversy about it, though, and that's why they finally settled it like last year that you can use either pronunciation.
Ra or Ray. By the way, one of our experimenters...
Oh, no, I'm looking at he's right. It's in the encyclopedia.com. Also Ray, R-E.
One of our experimenters tomorrow night, one of our investigators who was at the Balanced Rock in northern New York State, His nickname is Ra or Ray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think this is referring to him.
No.
I don't think.
Can't say Ra Charles, but you can say, if it's by itself, you can just say Ray.
Yeah.
I like Ra better.
Okay, we are 19 minutes after the hour. Time is moving at warp speed. We need to move on, Thomas. Let's go. Listen to the next weird stuff.
So this is this is kind of going on, I hear another tone, and this tone, it was a lot more clear, and it kind of came in and out, it sort of fades in. So I've done that item number 12. You'll hear the tone kind of fade in. I repeated that three times.
Okay.
And then it comes back in for a longer period. So you can play number 13 right after. And this is actually connected to the picture that's in my linked files, which is item number 4, which is a picture of the spectrograph. And you see where the peak is. So play it first, and then we'll sort of unveil what the frequency ended up being.
Okay, here it is, number 12 in your items. Repeat it three times. Oh, that's a clear tone.
Yes, that is very clear. And then if you go into number 13, this is the tone that extends longer. Yeah.
Let me go to 13, going to 13. Sound like Spock on the Enterprise. Let me do that again. That was cool. So these are the first real tones we've ever received.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's a lot of it. There seems to be, again, like it's not like there's, you know, like 1,000 different tones. I mean, that's definitely one of the clear ones. The crazy thing is that is pi.
You're kidding.
It's like, you know, if you take a look at where it's sitting on the spectrograph, it's like, you know, 99. I mean, again, like the analyzer that I'm using,
you know, is kind of, I kind of zoomed in as far as I can kind of go, but it's like, you know, I would say like 99.9% close to being the value of pi, which is extremely
weird. You mean 3,140 or 314?
No, that's 314.
Hertz.
Yeah. Sorry, 3.14 kilohertz.
Kilohertz, right.
Let me play it again. This is pretty amazing.
Yeah, so that's a high tone.
This is pi.
Pi.
So just as like...
Wow.
So, and then just to kind of give a comparison, so there's another another section in, so, and if you play item number 5, this is a different tone. So this is 558 hertz. I don't know necessarily what the significance of that number is. I mean, it's just, it's something that was also picked out. This is at the 82 minute, yeah, number of 15 on the SoundCloud links. And that's, this is,
you said number 5.
Oh, sorry, number 15.
All right, let me bring 15 up. Okay, here we are. 558 hertz.
Yeah.
It sounds like
now the crazy thing is that this actually sort of shifts down, like it slowly kind of goes down, which we didn't do. I mean, that's not a part of any of the signal that we put out. So I mean, this is something very strange.
So it's Doppler shifting, like a train going away.
But it's super, super mild. Like it's maybe going down 10 hertz, you know, go from like 558. I mean, that's like, if you play number 16, just to help people at home to kind of, to look for what we're listening to here.
Every help
number
16, helps.
Yeah. So number 16, I actually is just a pure tone, a 558 hertz pure tone that I created with a tone generator.
All right. Let me play it.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if you go to the again, back to 15 to hear it sort of in context.
Here we are. Starts there. It continues. It's continuing under that background.
I couldn't hear the other one, but I could hear this one.
So then finally kind of getting through it. So again, I don't know really what the significance of 558 hertz, but again, that behavior only happens kind of like, you know, like once, and then it doesn't happen for the rest of the recording. You don't hear that frequency again anywhere. And then there was another one, the other kind of, you know, I guess significant frequency that we found is 2.52 kilohertz, which is at the 72 minute 15 second mark of Maria's recording. That's item number 17.
Okay, here's 17. So all we have to figure out is what 558 is.
Well, no, that's 2.52 kilohertz, so 2000.
No, I was talking about the previous one and then this one.
Well, this is why 558 is kind of important, because, again, at 18, I sort of was incorrect because I'd originally said that the 558 hertz only came in once. The 558 hertz comes in again at the 84-minute mark, and that was the final kind of like sound item there.
Okay. Yeah, I hear it. It begins about one third of the way in.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. So I don't know what the significance of 558 is, but I mean that's definitely kind of there.
Well, we'll spend a week looking, and we'll all have the answer by next Sunday or Saturday.
Yeah. So bottom line, I mean, in terms of some of the evidence that we've been able to get, I mean, I wish we received, you know, basically plans on how to build some type of machine or something, a la Contact. But I mean, to have been able to have picked out a voice, like a clear voice, and these tones, which have some type of some type of intelligence behind it, and then really just the absolute vast richness.
Okay, let me raise a specter here. We've got for the weird voice, which you got to listen to like three or four times before you begin to. It's like so ghostly under the noise in the background. We've got Ray. Okay. Great, okay. What if it's saying gray?
Well, like in
alien grays, like a species somehow connected to humans, which is in the backdrop of UAPs and UFOs and abductions, and could that be it?
Well, when I played this for my wife, she was the first person, because when I heard the voice, I wasn't even thinking. I was so taken aback and so shocked to have heard the voice because it kind of popped out of nowhere. When I played it for her and I had it looped so she kind of could listen to it like we did just now, the first thing that she said was gray. And I was like, please don't say that, because it's just like a really, you know, but you know, I think gray, ray, great. I'm leaning kind of now more towards great myself, but there's something there.
You know, that's one of those kind of ironic things I say all the time. Oh, great. So we got ray, great, or gray. And that has really interesting implications. You want to hear more? Stick around for the next half hour. We're going to take you places that maybe some of you don't want to go. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. I want to delve into the meaning of all this. Do we know enough to impart or decode or intuit a meaning? Or do we need more? A straight line from the Great Pyramid to the world's, to the Europe's biggest nuclear reactor invaded by the Russians two nights ago. And then a straight line from Giza to Chernobyl, which the Russians invaded a week ago. Are you discerning a pattern here? We shall return.
Other side of midnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment for your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to the other side of midnight, which is really now in the land of enchantment, the other side of midnight, on this Sunday morning, March 6, 2022. And what you've been listening to for the last 2.5 hours plus now is transmissions from somewhere, someone, somehow, from something, somewhere in or out of time. Because in addition to the tonal qualities, a mysterious voice saying Ray or Great or Gray, we have connections between Giza and the largest nuclear reactor in Europe, just invaded by the Russians. And then we've got connections between Giza and Chernobyl, invaded by the Russians. And I guess I want to start this half hour, this last half hour, by giving a little bit of background. So let me direct you back to the other side of midnight on the guest page. I want you to click on my name. That will take you to my items in Radio with Pictures. Item 3 and 4 have to do with the invasion of Chernobyl about a week ago, and then 2 nights ago, the invasion of the nuclear reactor that they actually fired. They fired, you know, tracers. They fired artillery shells. It looked like they were trying to do something really dastardly. And yet we got this as a recording from our ET friends from somewhere or somewhen or somehow days before, excuse me, weeks in this case, before the events actually occurred. So what is going on? Okay, I want to direct you to item number 5, because science is projection of data that you know into the unknown that you don't know as of yet. Item number 5, I've got a GO satellite image of the Tonga explosion in the Southwest Pacific at 20.6 degrees south latitude. The reason we know that the transmissions were telling us about Tonga is because they came in the frequency meter, as David was, you know, recording his modalities at 20.6. So it was obviously a prediction 2 weeks before, during the Christmas weekend radio receptions and transmissions, of what was going to happen. Now, why is Tonga important? Because it was, and the estimates are all over the map. I've seen 18 megatons. I've seen over 50 megatons. It was an extraordinary explosion from the ocean floor into the mesosphere above the stratosphere at an altitude of something like 30 plus miles, 34, 35 miles. Now take a look at number 6. What I've done is I've still framed the GO satellite imagery so I could capture a single frame. And just as this explosion erupted from the ocean surface, it had a cubical geometry. And on the cubical geometry, there were 4 dark dots arrayed, as you can see by the comparison, with 5 black dots with one in the center, 4 with one in the center making 5, that basically looked like a 5-dice cube. A 5-die. And David and I went back and forth about the meaning of 5. Well, it turns out that it's related mathematically to the Great Pyramid. Item number 7. This is the comparison of the satellite view of the eruption of the cube from the ocean with a side view taken by a ship that was fortunately close enough to get good video and far enough away to not be smashed flat by the stunning shock waves. And you can see literally the 2-dimensional perspectives of this cube erupting at sunset from the ocean, literally at sunset at the Terminator. And then number seven, this is several minutes later as the cloud, these are all clickable, by the way, if you click on them, they get much bigger. As the cloud is expanding upward into space, the inner geometry forms a series of nested cubical geometries over and over again. In fact, when I was on with George Noory the other night, he looked at this image and he said, wait a minute, explosions don't form cubes. I mean, he was stunningly correct, because they don't. Let me tell you what does form a cube in three dimensions. A projection of energy into three dimensions from a higher dimension, from four or five or six, because the first three-dimensional construct that you can create after a point, a line, and then a three-dimensional figure in three space are two interlocked tetrahedrons which form a cube. So someone 2 weeks before this unprecedented, and it's getting tiresome saying that in the last several years, unprecedented explosive energetic event in the South Pacific at 20.6 south latitude, predicted by our ET transmissions 2 weeks before, someone was warning us of the projection of extraordinary energies from a higher dimension into our three-dimensional reality in the safety of an ocean where the closest island, Tonga, only had, I think, a few people killed. I say only because it's like, if you're going to do this in a meaningful way, you can't move the real estate out of the way. So someone decided that the message was more important than those lives. And someone else apparently told us weeks before this was going to occur. Now, if you're part of the global deep state or the global military-industrial complex, you realize in looking at this and doing a lot more analysis, because you have a lot more data than we do tonight, you realize that this is a confrontation with someone controlling energies which transcend, supersede anything that any governments or private entities on the planet are supposedly capable of controlling. I keep trying to rationalize why Putin has invaded against every norm, every counterintuitive fact and figure and extrapolation, why he has invaded Ukraine. And then, in succession, taken control of two nuclear reactors, which, if they were even slightly destabilized, would create the most horrific catastrophe for humankind in the 21st century, because if he does it to one, he could do it to all of them, and he is putting himself in position. And somewhere, somehow, in these transmissions, the importance of these sites were being flagged again weeks before they actually took place. So what's the backdrop? What's the meaning? Who is trying to tell us what about events to come, the effect on the planet, the effect on humanity, and who, in fact, might be behind the incredibly recent negative events that we see unfolding 24/7 now on national television? It's at this point I think I want to bring Georgia in, because, Georgia, you've been doing some thinking about this, and you've got a potential list.
The list. This is only a partial list, some of the entries on the list are probably more probable than others, but we don't want to box in the box at this point. We want to be able to think in ways that, you know, may turn out to be nothing, but are a little different. I've got a couple categories here. A couple of them will need some explanation. The first category, which you brought up, is are we talking to family out there? And if we are talking to family, are they current societies out there, or are they ancient past, perhaps coming through time in some way? Are they close, perhaps within this planet, on bases within this planet, or are they far out there? What is their agenda? Are they indifferent? Are they trying to warn us? These are all questions that would relate to the category of family. Then you can talk about other dimensions. Are we talking about parallel universes? Are we talking about higher realms that humanity accesses only in that transition that we call death? You know, where do EVPs come from? Is it higher realms? Is it what the Hindus call the Deva kingdom, which is a parallel kingdom to consciousness? We would call it a kingdom of form or matter. On the low end of that would be, for instance, the little flower fairies and nature spirits. On the higher end would be angels and archangels. That's a whole nother category. Then you've got the planetary hierarchy, the spiritual adepts and masters, those of the human race that have remained behind on this planet to teach and instruct humanity as to its identity. And then you've got a category which I call us, and that one needs a little bit of explanation. I'll give you an example of something that happened to me when I was about 9 years old. I was 9 years old playing with my cousins at a friend's farm, and it was getting towards sunset, and I decided to just go be by myself. Now, I hadn't remembered this memory ever, and a few years back, I was doing my daily meditations. I wasn't meditating on time or anything like that. And as I was sitting in meditation, this memory popped up. It was more than a memory. It was a reenactment, really. I was my adult self in meditation, but I was also my child self experiencing this again. And as a child, I extricated myself from my cousins and went down to the shore of the lake. And I remember it was about sunset. I remember looking up at the sky and just feeling really anxious and frustrated. And I remember as a child, of course, re-experiencing it now in my meditation, I remember as a child getting very frustrated and looking up at the sky and saying, why am I here? What am I supposed to do? What does it all mean? And my adult self in meditation and re-experiencing this immediately flooded my younger self with love and support and basically an attitude of don't worry, everything will work out fine. And I remember as a child when that frustration reached a pitch, all of a sudden there was this peace that descended. And I realized I was the answer to my own prayer, that there was a loop that was created between myself as a child and myself as an adult giving the answer. So,
So you were literally linking across the time stream, and you were the one you had been waiting for.
Exactly.
Wow.
So, and I also realized in meditation that if this could be done, if that kind of loop could be created in a lifetime, why not over several lifetimes?
Oh, wow.
So are we talking to us in the future?
Oh, my God.
So those are just a few categories that, you know, might involve taking a look.
Okay, the floor is open. Who wants to respond?
Richard, I should mention that this is common in in the OBE sort of world that, that I live in. And in fact, in one of my episodes, I used 3D animation to reenact a time when I go out of body, I get an emergency signal, I go back and I'm in England and it's a pirate ship and I'm watch myself fighting these pirates and I'm almost, then I die and I go up in the sky through the tunnel and then I'm pulled into this guy's body. Now I'm fighting these pirates. I'm like, what the hell? And I have to save this woman. So my past life called. It was so, the alarm signal was stronger than any other. It was like, oh my God, help, 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 help. So I had to get this woman there, and my old self called, and I heard, and I went back, and I got the woman there, and once she was safe, I exited that body, and it hit the dirt, and I headed home. So, yeah, you do go back and help yourself.
And the corollary to that is that if all of our incarnations are going on simultaneously, there are future incarnations that have solved the very troubles that we are dealing with now, and we can become receptive to our future selves that has the answer.
Well, you know, that's very... Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, what I was going to say is that, you know, another way to sort of look at it is that you've got basically every single kind of possibility of, you know, I guess within time, kind of like this idea of sort of like a multidimensional kind of matrix, like layers upon layers. And, you know, we are kind of existing within what is the most kind of like probable sort of thing at the moment. But the reality is that everything is to happen, has already happened, you know, and is currently happening. So it's kind of like, you know, the idea of sort of like a zero point, you know, could be applied to the time as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, where and what and how, you know, we're sort of attempting to communicate with is, you know, I guess still the mystery. But, I mean, it definitely sort of seems like we're honing in to something. You know, the quality of the evidence that we're getting is definitely kind of ramping up from the initial sort of attempts back in December, and continues to kind of, you know, lead us down this path together.
Built a software, a computer software that follows the algorithms and the decoding methods I'm using, you could literally be live listening to a reception from a transmission, and it would spit out all these possible locations on the planet.
Well, the other night, David, let me interrupt, because we don't have a lot of time left, and I want to get back to Maria. The other night when I was on with George and I was laying out the Tonga and intimating, teasing about the Ukrainian stuff, he said to me very matter-of-factly, he says, well, wouldn't it be useful if you could have decoded this, you know, 2 weeks before, like almost in real time before Tonga, before, you know, and
that's exactly what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. So
software,
so
we would need money to do that.
This is where
we
need funding. We need funding. We need other expertise. We have a vast audience in 193 countries. Who knows who's listening? Thomas came to us randomly, ha ha ha, by being recommended to listen to what we're doing. And he has put his heart and soul and 110% into this and has produced amazing results. There's got to be more Thomases out there. There's got to be computer experts. There's got to be people that deal in cryptography and codes. There's got to be people who are, you know, signals processing is second nature. They can, you know, lift those voices up to where we can actually hear them more clearly. Maybe superposition or some kind of spectral filtering or whatever. In other words, we need more expertise, because the reason we're doing this, I mean, the reason this is coming at the end of my 40-plus years of trying to get humanity to pay attention to what's around us in the solar system that's artificial, that was built by somebody, most likely our great-great-great-great-grandmothers, is because I think now, it's the only thing that can intercede and stop the insanity, the road we are apparently on, where we're literally tonight poised, as we haven't been since the Cold War, on the edge of someone who has twice now threatened to use nuclear weapons in this current conflict.
Richard?
If I can throw one more quick thing in here. You're calling for people with different skills. I think that perhaps some road we might go down is to find a reputable, experienced remote viewer and have them target on these signals.
Oh, now that's interesting.
No, but we're better than that. We've got data that's already telling us where the signals lead, but we're decoding it after the fact and proving it mathematically to precision. Like, I just got Pyramid of Chernobyl while we've been sitting here tonight going through the video I recorded of Maria's, you know, data. So that means if we had, all we need is a software that can read those frequencies and convert them, and I could tell a programmer exactly how I'm doing it. And
well, it may already exist. We just don't know about it because we don't live in that universe. And if there's someone listening who does, and they say, oh, you need such and such, we don't have to write our own code. Worst case scenario, there's someone out there that could help us write the code so we could do this literally in real time and anticipate the future warning that someone is now twice, more than twice, is repeatedly giving us, obviously, to try to be helpful.
Well, no,
Richard?
I'll note that I do have one more location that's very sensitive. I'll tell you off the air what it
okay,
is, Richard,
okay.
Because if I gave it out, it could be damaging.
Understand. Who is that trying to?
That was me.
Ron.
It's Ron. I'd like to throw a thought in here. I was thinking to myself something that I thought was too absurd to mention, which is
kidding.
When you were talking
on this show,
when you were talking about when you were talking about things coming from other dimensions, I'm thinking, or other planets, I'm thinking, well, along with the signal from contact, there was the one that was received that started the Andromeda strain, you know. But then I thought, okay, what about somebody just messing with us from another dimension, which led me to Mr. Mitzpitlick, the legendary imp from the fifth dimension in the Superman series. And yes, it's pronounced a bunch of different ways. That part's not my fault. And so I said, well, okay, he appeared first in October 1944. Well, what was going on in October 1944? Specifically World War II. There was the an attack by the Russians on something in Warsaw, and one of the largest sea battles ever fought. So maybe there is a connection.
I would think this is more future-oriented where we are now. There may be analogies to the past. A lot of people in the last, you know, week have been comparing this to 1939, et cetera, and nobody did anything, and look what happened, and now we're frozen because we can't do anything because nuclear weapons are involved, and one of the participants has avidly, you know, warned of nuclear weapons twice redundantly and has taken over two nuclear sites in Ukraine. There's a trend curve there. It'd be very nice if we had more forward-looking radar as to what could happen next so we can forestall it, and that may be the short-term use of what we're doing in a very practical sense. If we
get
the right help.
That's,
That's what my fourth location is, Richard. It is what could happen next, and I'll tell you off the air.
In 2010, here they are going out to investigate this monolith and back home on Earth.
There's a confrontation between the Soviet Union and us around Costa Rica. Yeah, Cold War.
I mean, I think something that we should be kind of just taking into consideration here is that, you know, let's kind of bringing this back to what we're like, what frequencies we're putting this out on. Again, I mean, we've been hoping to kind of tap into some type of an ancient kind of communication network. And, you know, the analogy that we've been doing is that, you know, with these signals that we're putting out there, we're trying to tickle that, like, hyperdimensional ether, the matrix. And basically, like, you know, I think these big events, you know, like a big energetic release like Tonga or like significant sort of conflict, you know, that has the general sort of human emotional level very, very high, are significant sort of impacts onto this network, this matrix, this hyperdimensional kind of web. As well, right? So, you know, thinking of it kind of like a giant kind of interconnected spider web that you're sort of feeling these reverberations.
Well, we have a great thing, and I'm going to go back to Maria, because Maria, and we got about 2 minutes, the next data point we're going to get, or data points, is from Egypt, because you're going to the Giza Plateau.
Yes, that's right. I'll be there from the 18th of March. To the 1st of April, and I'm just waiting back to hear exactly when I will be at the Great Pyramid and what time, so I can relay that to you. But just briefly, well, we've heard the words grey or great or Ra, or, you know, but when I was at Stonehenge, what I heard come out of Stonehenge was peace. That is what I heard in my head as I was looking, doing the recording. So I do think there's a lot of hope in what we're doing.
Well, that would mean that what we're doing can somehow impact what everybody wants, which is peace. And I think we just need to get better at what we're doing, which means we definitely need more help. So if you have an expertise, if you're an intuitive, if you're a remote viewer, if you're an electronics expert, if you're a cryptographer, if you're, you know, CIA, and you get tickled by this, get hold of us. The contact information is on the website, and we're going to pick up with part two tomorrow night, more decodings, more reaching out for more help, and maybe, just maybe, some actual answers. And don't everybody speak at once.
Be there or be square.
Hey, you know, folks, we run to the end of our runway. So I want to thank everybody, and I'm not going to name them all because I'll forget somebody, like I forgot Ron the other night on Coast to Coast. You know, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa. I will remedy that the next time, Ron. So until tomorrow night, there we are. You are on the other side of midnight. This has been 3 hours of trying to decode the undecodable. One thing we do know, we're getting messages somehow ahead in time. Can we regularize that? Can we make it systematic? Can we pick it up in real time? Can we have an impact on the trends of future history in the next several weeks? Join us tomorrow night. Same time, same bat channel. And remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone. See you tomorrow night.